Welcome to a special holidays edition of Ask Special Sauce. Serious eaters from around the globe have sent us their holiday cooking and eating questions, and here to answer them are two indisputably serious eaters, our very own Kenji Lopez-Ault, who is also the author of the New York Times bestseller The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, and Serious Eats resident pastry wizard Stella Parks, who wrote another New York Times bestseller, Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts.
Stella has the sort of French chef's philosophy where there's no problem that can't be solved with more butter, and I have sort of the alcoholic's philosophy where there's nothing that can't be solved with more vodka.
I'm from the South.
All right, let's dive right into the questions. This is from Twirly Girly. Dear Special Sauce, I'm planning to make peppermint bark for the holidays using high quality, in paren, Calbo white and bittersweet chocolates, which I also plan to temper. In perusing recipes on the internet, I've discovered that there are a lot of issues that people have with not being able to get the two layers of chocolate to stick together. Some of these recipes call for the use of chocolate morsels, some of them for high-quality chocolate, some call for tempering the chocolate, some do not. There are recipes that require putting the dark chocolate layer in the freezer or fridge for a time before pouring the white chocolate over it. So since peppermint bark is such a popular food item during the holidays, you two need to come to Twirly Girly's rescue.
Yeah, to me this sounds like an issue of temperature management, and what's happening is white and dark chocolate are both tempered at different temperatures. White chocolate's taken to a little bit of a higher temperature and dark chocolate to a little bit of a lower temperature, and they're setting at different rates. And so I think what's happening is one chocolate is, whichever it's the top layer or the bottom layer, one chocolate is starting to set and solidify really quickly, and the other one is remaining kind of liquid and loose, and then they're curling away from each other because they're just setting at different rates. And I would think that the refrigeration or freezing process would exacerbate that, because it's going to make there be more of a discrepancy between the chocolates as they set together. So I would not do that and try and work in such a way that the chocolates are a similar temperature, as similar as you can make them.
And you think that'll solve the problem?
I think it will. I mean, granted, like when you look at any number of recipes on the internet, you do notice like consistent problems cropping up over and over and over again. Especially with chocolate, I think it's a sign of, it's a squeaky wheel that gets the grease, right? The people who are having trouble are leaving comments, and the people who are having a successful day with their peppermint bark aren't saying anything. And so I think it's the people who aren't tempering their chocolate, and then the people who are trying to cheat tempering by, you know, tossing their chocolate in the fridge or freezer, who end up having these troubles over and over again. And so I think with tempered chocolate and keeping the chocolates at a reasonably similar temperature would really go a long way in avoiding some of that.
So, Kenji, even though you're not a sweets person, I know you're not a dessert person, but the new book is going to have 10% more science to it. And this seems to be a scientifically oriented question.
Well, I was gonna go back to my background in structural engineering and suggest a completely different approach. So traditionally, I think those two layer peppermint bark is made with a layer of dark chocolate on the bottom, which you'd let chill, and then you pour the white chocolate on top, and then you let that chill, and you embed the crushed up candy canes in that. What I was going to suggest is actually adding a second layer of structural crushed candy cane to there. So pour your dark chocolate, sprinkle it with a little bit of the crushed candy canes, and that way, when you pour the white chocolate on top, you have sort of these little nooks and crannies for it to grab onto. And that way the two layers, and maybe there are probably people who are, I mean, there are people who are passionate about everything, and there's probably people who are passionate about peppermint bark who would say that adding a layer of candy cane in the middle makes it no longer peppermint bark. So if you're one of those people, you probably don't want to try this method, but, I think that would solve your problem pretty easily, because it would guarantee that there's something for that white chocolate to sort of set around when you pour it over the dark chocolate.
Stella, what do you think of Kenji's hypothesis?
Yeah, I think that definitely gives the white chocolate a little something to cling to. There may still be an issue of, you know, if the dark chocolate is cool and the crushed candy is cool, and then the white chocolate is added to it, and they're setting at really different rates. I mean, there may still be like a possibility that they, especially when you cut them, that friction, like they pop open, that, and maybe that could also be a point of weakness, like as the knife is cutting through, there's this stuff to catch on, and it might, I'm not sure how that would affect it. Mm. I haven't tried it that way.
I mean, that's when you just, I think, just pour more wine and serve it in the dark.
Yeah.
I see. So you're trying to drug your dinner guests.
Yeah, spike the eggnog extra hard.
All right, so Sarah A. has a question about, this is something that you both know a fair amount about. I've heard that substituting some of the cold water in pie crust dough with vodka, where have we heard this before, Kenji, helps keep the crust from getting tough. While I know the alcohol would cook off, is there really any truth to this? She is throwing down.
Well,
here, Sarah.
I happen to know quite a bit about this because that the whole idea of putting vodka into a pie crust was actually a recipe I developed for Cooks Illustrated back in 2007. I think it was the second recipe I ever developed for Cooks Illustrated. It absolutely does have an effect. For that development process, I think there was 135 individual tests that I did on there. And I landed on the vodka thing.
You're
maybe
insane. Could I say that?
About three quarters of the way through. It absolutely does. So Stella has different views on this because we have sort of different views on pie crust, period, which Stella can get into afterwards. But for me, a pie crust should be both tender and flaky. So in order to get something tender and flaky, you need to develop a tiny bit of gluten, but mainly you want to keep it, you really want to keep that gluten development in check, and that's what's going to make it tender. The problem is that gluten develops in the presence of water and flour. When you add too much water to your pie dough, it can cause too much gluten formation, and that can make your pie dough tough. It can make it a little bit leathery. But if you don't use enough water, it can make it very difficult to roll out because the dough is not hydrated enough. So that's what happens when you try and roll it out, and it cracks and it crumbles, and it's very difficult to work with. So a lot of people accidentally end up actually adding too much water to their pie dough. The vodka sort of gets around this because gluten doesn't develop in alcohol, but you can still use alcohol to hydrate the dough. So you use vodka, it makes the dough really easy and malleable, almost like Play-Doh. It rolls out really, really easily. And then as it cooks, that most of the vodka, most of the alcohol burns off in the same way that most of the water actually goes away as well. There's probably still trace amounts in there, but, you know, not any more than would be sort of in your average loaf of bread. So you don't really have to worry about the alcohol left in there. But it absolutely does make a difference in terms of making a pie dough that's easier to work with, that also sort of comes out much more tender than it traditionally does. Now, I know Stella probably wants to jump in and say something about her pie crust because she sort of takes the opposite approach that I do on hers.
Yes, and now this is like a crossfire for pie dough.
So one thing I would say, maybe a caveat to, you know, Kenji saying there is an effect and it does help and it can make your crust more tender. This is particularly true if you're using a relatively low fat dough. I don't mean low fat in any type of like health conscious way, but if the fat represents a relatively small percentage of the overall, you know, makeup of the dough, the vodka, yeah, is absolutely a helpful way to keep things tender without, you know, encouraging excess gluten development. But I go about a different way to keep my gluten in check. Instead of using something like vodka to limit gluten development, I use a higher proportion of butter. So if you were to try and swap some vodka in my pie dough, it would not necessarily make it more tender. It would cause some structural damage because it would inhibit the gluten from developing because there's already plenty of butter holding the gluten in check. And so if you were kind of to double up on that, you get this really crumbly, messy dough that wouldn't have the nice, like, you know, plasticity and ability to be handled. So, and this is true of almost any kind of baking advice. When someone says, you know, this one ingredient will change everything, it's likely that this one ingredient changes everything in a very specific style of recipe that's not necessarily like universally applicable. So in my pie dough recipe in particular, vodka is not a great idea because I want gluten development. I want a little bit more than most. I think a lot of people have experienced that situation where your pie dough is too crumbly and you're having to really carefully roll it up onto your rolling pin to transfer it to the pie shell, or you're, you know, folding it in quarters to try and get it over there, and you're shaping it. It's just kind of crumbling between your fingers as you're crimping the crust or something. And all of those to me are signs that there's not enough gluten development. And having gluten doesn't mean something is going to be tough necessarily. That's excess gluten. So, you know, I don't think you have to be afraid of having gluten development, but you do have to have a plan. So you don't want to like kind of combine different techniques and different recipes. You want to find a recipe that's your style. And so Kenji has a style of pie dough that works for him, and that the vodka can be a good idea in that recipe, and there's, you know, that's its own recipe, and it works well. Mm-hmm. And then I've got my own style. And so just the tips that we recommend for our pie doughs aren't necessarily universal tips that go for everything.
Sarah has inadvertently walked into the great Serious Eats debate.
I think it really just comes down to a question of philosophy. You know, Stella has the sort of French chef's philosophy where there's no problem that can't be solved with more butter. And I have sort of the alcoholic's philosophy.
Wow.
Where there's nothing that can't be solved with more vodka.
I'm from the South.
All right. So Penny S. has a question because she makes turkey for the holidays. And she wants to know, what the heck is in that bag inside the turkey?
The bag inside the turkey? Oh, you mean like the little plastic bag that's inside the cavity?
Great. Yeah. So she says, I figured out the neck, but everything else is suspect, as in do not use that liver.
Okay. There's usually four things in that bag. There's the neck, which is the obvious one. It looks like a skinned turkey neck. Then there's the heart, there's the gizzard, and there's the liver. So the heart, I mean, it looks like a heart. You know, we've all seen pictures of hearts in anatomy in movies. It looks like a heart, the turkey heart, and the gizzard. So the gizzard is actually an organ that's unique to birds. I believe it's unique to birds. Maybe there are other types of animals that have them too. But the gizzard is essentially a sack of muscle. And you know that birds don't have teeth. They have beaks. So they swallow their food whole. But they still need a way to grind up that food. You know, the mealworms and the bugs and whatever they're eating has to get ground up. So what they do is they swallow little rocks and pebbles. And those rocks and pebbles are stored inside their gizzard. And then as the food passes through it, this sort of muscular organ grinds up the food using those rocks and pebbles. So the gizzard is sort of a very tough muscular organ that comes from the base of the turkey's neck. And finally, there's the liver. And the liver is the one that looks, it's the dark red sort of one that looks sort of, you know, has a sort of like pudding-like texture almost. As far as what you do with those things, well, there's a number of things. Some people like to saute them, chop them up, and add them to their gravy. I like doing that. The other thing you can do is you can feed them to the pets, which I sometimes do. Or you can save them for the next morning. If you're very good at making omelets, especially like French omelets, it's a very sort of traditional French thing to use sauteed chicken hearts, gizzards, and livers, sauteed in butter, and use that almost as sort of like a stuffing or sauce for your omelets. I think it does really well with turkey hearts, gizzards, and livers. So you just saute them, chop them up, saute them the morning after Thanksgiving, make yourself a nice omelet, add some butter in there, add a little bit of your turkey stock to make sort of a nice pan sauce, and then pour that over an omelet, and I think it's delicious. And of course, the other thing you can also do is chop it up and add it to your stuffing. Sauteed in butter, add it to your stuffing.
So, Stella, what does your mother-in-law do with that bag?
I suspect my mother-in-law pitches it. but
that's,
when John...
That's not politically correct these days, you know.
she's definitely not too concerned with that. She's not going to fool with the weird stuff, as she would probably say. But John and I, we usually pick up a turkey and kind of have our own little mini Thanksgiving where we can, because we're adventurous eaters. We want to make all kinds of different stuff and maybe steer a little bit away from like the super traditional Thanksgiving. So we kind of always have a fakesgiving of our own, and John always kind of minces up those parts, and he does some like brown butter sage situation, and he like cooks them in that, and then he hits it with some sherry, and it's kind of like a really rough and tumble pate. I mean, the neck doesn't go in there, obviously, and it's really nice over toast. So we have that kind of almost like a tapas with a glass of wine.
That sounds good, because obviously it would be perfect for a Christmas dinner or a holiday dinner as well if you're making turkey. So Kate G. has a question about the joys of making homemade caramels and toffee to give as holiday gifts. And she says, over the years, I've clipped recipes, and she's tried everything, and she still can't solve the problem of what happens if, when you're making caramel, it rains. So she says she's tried every trick she could think of to dehumidify the kitchen, yet pot after pot of sugar failed to turn to rich, thick caramel. Then real tragedy struck. Whole Foods stopped stocking my caramels. I was forced to go cold turkey, no pun intended, yet have never fully recovered from my caramel addiction. I recently read Stella's article on toasted sugar. The mention of the sugar caramelizing around the edges during the toasting process caught my eye. I've been thinking about taking another crack at making caramel again, but winter is upon us. And I learned the hard way that when it rains, there is no making caramel. So, Stella, can your oven trick help? And Kenji, can your knowledge of science help? Is it possible to make caramel in the rain using the oven?
Real quick, you don't want to use oven-toasted sugar for caramel. Oven-toasted sugar is an extremely time-consuming process that's extraordinarily delicious, but because it's so time-consuming, using it for a traditional caramel is a bad idea because you can make caramel on the stove in like 5 minutes.
And you're going to be caramelizing that sugar anyway, so it's sort of like you're wasting it, right?
Yeah, you're totally wasting it. The dry roasted sugar should be saved for baked goods and non-traditional, non-candy applications. Unless it was something like marshmallows, if you wanted to use toasted sugar and marshmallows. That'd be a cool way to add in flavor, but you don't want to liquefy it into a caramel. And the deal is this, rain doesn't matter. Restaurants, bakeries, pastry shops, confectioners, nobody shuts down their business when it rains because that's not really a relevant factor in candy making.
What would happen in Seattle if they shut down bakeries during rain?
There's no confections in Seattle. Humidity really matters when it comes to storage. If you're, if you've made some caramels and they're sitting out indefinitely on the counter and you've got like a relative humidity of, I don't know, like 15% in your house and it's, getting pretty crazy, like that's going to be a problem because the candy's sitting out and it has time to absorb moisture from the air. So time and humidity do matter in terms of storage. So if you don't have a good seal on your container, the unfortunate part is that Kate hasn't actually articulated what the problem is, like whether her caramel is liquefying, whether it's not holding a tight shape, or whether it's crystallizing or turning grainy. One thing that I'm really evangelical about is having people switch to diamond crystal kosher salt for any of their candy making adventures because it's completely free of any type of additives. And other brands of kosher salt include an anti-caking agent that interferes with sugar crystallization. So it can cause a wide range of problems in candies like toffee and caramel and fudge or anything like that. It can really cause some big textural problems. So I would say first and foremost to make sure you're using
salt. Like Morton's kosher salt is not just pure salt?
Yeah, it has yellow prussiate of soda in it. Oh. And that's sodium ferronicide. Yeah, and so absolutely will ruin your toffee every time. And I've had some readers write in saying they made either a recipe for my book or one of the caramel recipes I have on Serious Eats, and they'll have a problem, and I'll say, hey, were you using Morton salt? And they'll say invariably yes, and I'll say, try it with diamond crystal and get back to me, and 100% of the time that has resolved the issue. So it's definitely something people are experiencing.
It's interesting because everyone always assumes that all kosher salt is A, made of salt, and B, created equal.
I guess you got to check the ingredients list on your salt.
Yeah, tragically that's not the case. So that aside, that can be a really big issue. There are a couple different problems that come up with candy cookery. One is just getting a bad thermometer. During the course of making my book, I purchased several hundred dollars worth of different thermometers, digital and analog, and would have them all clipped to the pot. So I'd be getting 5 or 6 different readings as I'm making a recipe so I can make sure that I'm not relying on just one thermometer for my answers. And, there's a lot of thermometers out there that are just bad. You buy them and out of the box, they're bad, they're off, they're wrong. So it matters to use a good quality thermometer. And for candy making, you want a clip-on digital thermometer. Pocket thermometers are super great for testing meat, but if you're going to be cooking a candy, especially like a caramel where it's this long-term project, you've got to be monitoring it every step of the way. And just spot-checking it periodically is not really a safe or reliable way to get an accurate reading over time because you want constant real-time monitoring of your candy's cooking temperature. And also with candies, if you're spot checking with a pocket thermometer, if you don't really clean off that thermometer probe in between every measurement, one of the early measurements you take could actually have a sugar crystal on it. And then when you go to take another measurement later and the thermometer is still a little dirty, you may reintroduce sugar crystals into the mix, which can cause problems too. So it's important to have the right equipment and the right ingredients for candy making. And I think these things are so variable in terms of do you have a good thermometer that is accurately measuring your candy, and are you being secretly sabotaged by your salt? I think because of these variables, people have really tried to grasp onto the problem and not knowing that these things may actually be a problem. Say, well, you know, it was a rainy day. Maybe that was it. And so it's kind of become a little bit of a catch-all scapegoat kind of umbrella answer for when there's a problem. Barometric pressure actually does matter. So if you're having like a high pressure system come through or a low pressure system, that can cause some problems, and that may be associated with humidity in some cases. But humidity itself isn't really a problem.
And Kenji, I don't think you and I have ever talked about you making caramel. Have you ever tried to make caramel?
I've never actually made caramel candies. I make caramel sauce at the restaurant I'm opening soon. We're doing a dessert with our friends are making make this croissant bread. They take croissant dough and cook it in a Pullman loaf pan. So it comes out looking like a loaf of bread, but it has a sort of buttery texture of a croissant, and we're making this sort of like a caramelized French toast with a burnt caramel sauce for that. But it's not a sort of a chewy caramel candy. I guess the closest I've ever come to it is making homemade fudge, which I used to make to give out to friends on holidays. And I think that has some of the sort of the similar problems of getting that texture right. For me, the easiest, I mean, and Stella can maybe talk more about this or confirm it. For me, the easiest revelation came was when I stopped bothering trying to make it out of plain sugar and carefully monitoring the temperature and switching to mostly corn syrup, which I found is just a much easier way to make that the sort of chewy fudge candies, more foolproof, doesn't crystallize, easier to get that texture. Probably cheating, and maybe people probably wouldn't consider it real fudge. But I found that made things much easier. I don't know if that also applies to
faux fudge.
Caramels in general. But
what's your take on fudge, and do you have any response to Kenji's attempt?
First and foremost, I think it's important for anyone to use recipes that they feel comfortable working with. So like, I don't have a problem with that. I'm not like a believer in there's like only one true way to do anything. Like, there's different recipes for different occasions, and that's fantastic. So whatever gets you in the kitchen actually making fudge, I'm all about it. I don't use corn syrup in my recipe when I make fudge. And mostly because if you have enough fat products, like a good quality chocolate and milk and butter, then you're inhibiting crystallization through that. And if you've got a good salt, that's not going to encourage a weird crystallization, and a good thermometer, you can get around that. And so, you know, corn syrup may be creating a little bit more of a friendlier recipe, or a recipe that's a little bit more foolproof in the face of insufficient equipment or ingredients. But I don't think it's necessary. I think with just good temperature control, you can really accomplish a lot. And I also, my recipe is based on a 19th century recipe. And so my theory was, if these guys were cranking out fudge in, you know, the 1800s successfully, that, you know, we can too. So I wanted to kind of get back to this old school approach to fudge.
I have an existential, almost cosmic question about fudge. Is any fudge truly seriously delicious?
Oh, you haven't had my fudge.
No, I haven't.
I'm sort of with you on this. Fudge is like the fruitcake. It's like fruitcake.
Exactly. It's the first cousin of fruitcake.
I think a lot of fudges out there are really low on chocolate, and the chocolate that they do contain is maybe really low quality chocolate. I'm not going to like brand shame, but the really famous kind you get at the grocery store is not good. It doesn't taste like chocolate. It's really low in fat. It's not doing you any favors in any of your recipes, much less fudge. So I think that for starters is a big problem. When I make fudge, my recipe has half a pound of dark chocolate, like a 72% dark chocolate in there. And, you know, that goes a long way into making it delicious. And I also use a mix of light brown sugar and toasted sugar. So you're getting these molasses notes from the brown sugar, and you're getting these caramel notes from the white sugar. And then I also make it with milk, which is not that uncommon, milk and butter, rather than water or other liquids. And the milk and the butter kind of reduce and concentrate as the fudge is cooked, because it's cooked above 212 degrees, which means the water is being driven off. And that allows you to get some really good toffee notes out of the milk solids. So you're getting this kind of like toffee flavor happening there. So you've got like all these different sources of flavor in the fudge aside from the chocolate. And I use a lot of salt. I've got about 4 grams of salt in my recipe to under 2 pounds of sugar.
Wow.
And all this dark chocolate that's happening and a really generous portion of vanilla. So there's it's got a really nice depth of flavor.
Wow, like your fudge doesn't sound like any fudge I've ever tasted in my life, because most fudges are sweet and grainy and terrible. Yeah. There, I've said it.
Yeah, so you don't have to have that graininess.
Well, the grainy problem is the one that I had all the time. And you know, the there's actually two fudge recipes I've found that solve their problem, and both of them are cheaty fudge. One of them was the one from I think there's a recipe called Foolproof Fudge from Cooks Illustrated, and that was my colleague Dave Pasminio came up with that recipe, and that's the one that uses corn syrup instead of sugar. And the other recipe for fudge that I think is completely foolproof, and I was born in Boston, so I think I have to plug this, but it's the recipe for never fail fudge from the back of the jar of marshmallow fluff, where I think you just mix marshmallow fluff and chocolate, and
that's a very scientific thing you just laid on us.
But, you know, but marshmallow fluff is essentially, I think, just whipped up corn syrup with vanilla and maybe some stabilizers. But that recipe comes out non-grainy, very sweet, and probably not particularly, not much compared to, I'm sure, compared to Stella's real fudge. But if you've been having that graininess issue, I'm plugging those two recipes.
As a quick note, if you are having graininess issues with fudge, there are essentially only 3 causes for this, so it's not hard to troubleshoot. The first is what we kind of mentioned earlier, was that you could actually be having a type of salt that's interfering with the proper crystallization and causing some trouble. So it could be an issue related to your salt if it has additives. Another issue is overcooking. If your fudge has been cooked, say, to 250 or higher, that's going to cause it to have a grainy, sandy consistency. And, you know, again, this could be a problem with your thermometer if it's not accurate, or if it's a pocket thermometer and you haven't been actually monitoring the cooking process the whole time. You know, you can get some weird readings, or if your thermometer probe is not fully submerged in the syrup, if it's clipped on in a weird place, or, you know, you just kind of stick it in and it's not at least an inch into the syrup. Maybe your pot's too large, so you don't have enough depth of candy syrup to get a good reading. All of those things can lead to overcooking, even if you're actually getting what seems to be an accurate reading. It's a false reading. And then the other issue is premature agitation. And this just means, you know, a recipe may say something to cool to a specific temperature before stirring. And maybe a lot of recipes are vague about that. They say, you know, cool until lukewarm before stirring. And I provide a specific temperature in my recipe, so there's no question there. But if you stir fudge before it is cooled to a specific temperature, and I say 118 degrees, it will crystallize. Like, that's almost inevitable. So you just need to be patient and wait until it's sufficiently cooled before you start stirring. And I guess the fourth potential cause of graininess would be just, you know, not working clean. If you've got a fork or a spatula or a candy thermometer probe or a pocket thermometer probe that's got a grain of sugar on it from, you know, previous rounds of testing or something, and you're introducing a sugar crystal into the mixture like later in the cooking process. So just work clean, have good equipment, and follow the directions is kind of my fudge making advice.
I have to say that just listening to the two of you talk about food, I feel like people are asking basketball advice from Kevin Durant and LeBron James.
I wish I knew who those people were.
And you don't even follow sports, and neither of you care about sports. But there's a lot of food intel between the two of you. There isn't any question that you guys can handle. I'm really impressed, I have to say. It was a really smart idea to hire both of you for Serious Eats, you know, so.
Good job.
I want to know, just on a personal note, like, what's the thing that you guys both look forward to for the holidays when it comes to food?
For Christmas, my family usually does a prime rib. It's something my mom loves, and we've been doing that every year since I was a little kid. You know, I like prime rib well enough, but it's not something I like seriously look forward to every year. The thing we do at Christmas often, though, is make it like sort of a big fancy meal, so like a multi-course dinner where I sort of get to relive my restaurant days. So we get, you know, my dad springs for like fancy ingredients. So we'll often have like truffles. Sometimes we'll get some foie gras. My dad will always go. So my dad has an oystering license up in Boston. So he goes out to Wellfleet and digs up oysters. So he always brings some oysters to Christmas. My grandfather loves lobster, so my dad usually also brings a lobster down. So we kind of go all out at Christmas, and I just basically spend...
Wow, can I come?
Yeah.
I need to come.
For me, the joy of food at Christmas is more about actually the cooking and sort of getting to be, you know, thrown back into the fire a bit, and sort of, getting to sort of flex my cooking chops more than it is about the actual eating. I guess for my family, they probably enjoy all the eating.
Yeah, so you really throw down for the holidays. And you may not love prime rib, but I have dazzled my friends by making your prime rib recipe.
Well, thanks.
Dazzled.
I'm glad it works out for you.
Yeah, my dad uses that recipe every year, I believe.
It is awesome. It's on the site. It's in the book too, right, Kenji?
It is in the book, yes.
Kenji's prime rib recipe is sheer genius. So, Stella, what do you most look forward to for the holidays when it comes to food?
Historically, the holidays have been a really terrible time for me because of being in the restaurant industry, where it's just like not really a downtime and you're getting crazy and you're gearing up for New Year's and people are coming in for special holiday dinners. And so it's been kind of crazy. So these last 3 years, I have not been in the restaurant business. So it's still very new to me to have the time off, and it's such a precious joy that I can't really get over it. So my favorite thing right now about the holidays is being really lazy. And like, I'll do something like make up a pan of cinnamon rolls and have them like stuck in the freezer like months in advance. And then, you know, Christmas morning, I'm like at my parents' house and we're baking off cinnamon rolls. And the cool thing about that is I'll just like have directions written on the top, like, you know, bake 30 minutes, whatever, like written on the foil lid of the dough in a Sharpie. So my dad, who wakes up super early, can throw them in the oven. And then I get to sleep in, which is glorious. And then I get to wander into a kitchen to the smell of cinnamon rolls baking up. And I haven't done a damn thing. And it's pretty awesome. So that's a huge thing for me.
I can attest to this because several years ago, when I was driving around, I think doing a taco tour for Serious Eats, for an article we were writing, I stayed at Stella's house, and we came in, and she was baking cinnamon rolls when we got there. I think you were testing them for your book.
Oh, my God. I'm so jealous.
So I had that exact experience of just pulling in, doing no work, and coming into a house that smelled like awesome cinnamon rolls. And it really is.
So now I'm totally torn, like, whose house to go to for the holidays?
It's going
to
be a tough call.
I guess having not been invited to either, I guess it's time for us to go. But before we go, tell me a little bit about the restaurant. What's it called and when is it opening? And
oh, yeah. So the restaurant, it's called Wursthall. That's W-U-R-S-T, as in, you know, German for sausage. And it's a beer hall, opening in downtown San Mateo. Mainly, you know, family friendly place, mainly focusing on sort of sausages and sandwiches and appetizers and sort of, you know, fun beer-friendly food, 30 different beers on tap, and a cocktail bar as well. Aiming to open probably mid-January. Of course, you know, I think restaurant openings are sort of always a moving target because there's so many moving parts. But, you know, hopefully by early January, definitely by February. So if you are in San Mateo, come by and say hi.
That sounds awesome, and I do wish you the best for the Wurst.
Oh, thank you.
I had to say that. And Stella, would you please send me some of that fudge, because that sounds serious.
I will make sure that you get some before the end of this
all right.
year.
Thanks a lot. I'd like to thank all the Serious Eaters who sent in their questions. I hope we've answered them to your satisfaction. And of course, I'd like to thank my two co-pilots for this special holiday edition of Ask Special Sauce, J. Kenji Lopez-All, that's the whole name, the author of Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, and Stella Parks, the author of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts. It's been great. Swell. Have a great holiday, everybody. We'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.